My name is Chris Hoover. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
And I have a sobriety date, which is August 16, 2002. I have a home group, which is Midtown. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other young men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really privileged to be asked down here. Thank you, Sam. And, you know, it's good to be here. It was a nice drive down, you know, nice weather, no traffic. It's a good day to come down 66 on a Sunday. It's probably the only time you'll not hit traffic. And so I'm really, you know, honored to be asked to come down to this home group. And there's a lot of people here that I respect in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it's really good to be here. And I want to thank my sponsee over here for accompanying me. And my home group's on Sunday night, too. So it was a real, you know, it was a real hard draw to get anyone to come down here with me. So, but Andrew was nice enough to make the journey. He's probably getting some points in where he can. You know what I mean? God knows he needs them. He needs some extra credit right now. There's no doubt about it. And so I'm real grateful to be sober. And I think that, you know, I think that the longer you stay sober, I think the tougher it gets. You know, I mean, it seems easy when you're new. I mean, you got that heat on you and that desperation, you know, all the carnage that you just left behind you. It's very, you know, it's real. It's right there. And it's my opinion that the longer I stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more I actually have to do. I mean, it really is. And so when I say I'm grateful to be sober, I mean, I really mean it, you know. And my home group's a large home group, and we have what you call class dinners. And, you know, every year that my class is 2002, every year it gets smaller and smaller, you know. And it's a, you know, there's no greater joy to see the lights come on in a newcomer's eyes, but there's no greater pain to see that light go off, you know. And, you know, a couple good friends have left. People I've known my whole sobriety. And it's, you know, you could go through the list of whys, you know. I mean, you could really go through the list of whys and what was he doing, what was he not doing, you know. But I think at the end of the day that I'm sober because I, you know, of the grace of God, you know. And I'm still willing to do his work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's really it, you know. And it's hard to see people go, but I'm also glad I'm still here. And you know, and I hope that I always continue to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous in whatever capacity I'm asked to be of service in. And I mean, speaking is probably my least favorite thing to do because I always get really emotional at times. And it's hard to keep that tough guy veneer on, you know, I mean, when you're crying. And, you know, I mean, I got a bodybuilder over here as a pigeon. You know, what's he going to think? So, but I am really grateful. And I, you know, I mean, you know, my story is all I got. That's the only experience I have. You know, that's the only, you know, the only currency I think that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is our time and our attention and our experience. You know, there's nothing else that really matters to a newcomer, I don't think. You know, what I have on the outside or what kind of car I drive or where I live or what kind of clothes I wear is totally irrelevant to the newcomer. You know what I mean? All they want to know, whether they know it or not, is how to recover from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And so, you know, that's all I really have. And I'm not one of these speakers. I don't have a prepared talk. I don't, you know, I just kind of get up here and wing it like I have my whole life. You know what I mean? Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, but I grew up in Kensington, Maryland. And, you know, I was actually born in Washington, D.C. And then my family moved out to the suburbs. And I had a totally normal childhood. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, I can't. There's nothing, no one drank in my household. There's nothing I can point to that, you know, was a reason for me to be the way I was. And, you know, and honestly, I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about it either. I mean, you know, it is what it is, and now what are we going to do about it? That's where I'm at. And, you know, I was a troublemaker in school, and I like to cause, you know, a ruckus wherever I was. I think I was just looking for attention. And, you know, I was the kind of kid that we would have a couple of recesses one morning and one afternoon. I would go out on the soccer field with, I would always rope in a couple cronies with me too. I mean, I'm never doing anything alone. I want to make sure I got a couple of accomplices wherever I am. And, we would go dig holes in the soccer field, put little traps covered over with leaves, and then at the afternoon recess, we'd watch kids trip in it. You know what I mean? That was my idea of fun, you know, when I was a kid. And I was never really great in school. You know, I had a couple things I did that I was really good at, but mostly, I mean, I barely squeaked by, you know. And I always got those talks like all of us do. You got tons of potential, you know. And everyone would tell me that growing up. You got a ton of potential, you know. Why don't you just tap into that? And I would think, well, when I'm ready, I'm going to tap into that potential. That day has still not come, you know. I can promise you that. And so, you know, something happened when I was 15. My dad got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and you know, he got real sick real fast. You know, he was, you know. And when you're 15, the kind of relationship you have with your parents when you're 15 is you know, you really, you know, one of embarrassment. You don't want them to take you anywhere or drop you off anywhere. You know, I really didn't have much of a relationship with my father. And I just assumed he'd always be there, you know. And he got real sick and was bedridden in the house. And, you know, I just remember wanting to be as far away from it as I could be, you know. And I used to think that, you know, the lie I would tell myself while I was drinking was, well, if you were 15, your dad was dying of cancer, you wouldn't know how to handle that either, you know. And that's actually not true. You know, the truth about that after doing inventory and seeing the true nature of my selfishness is that I honestly didn't want to be bothered with it, you know. And all I could think about was how it was going to affect me, you know. Now, I couldn't have, you know, there's no way I could have seen that, you know, at 15. But I know that that's what it was because I have four sisters and they didn't do what I did. I have one younger and three older and they were all there helping, you know. When my dad needed to go to the bathroom, they were helping, you know. When he needed a shot of, you know, morphine, they were there. You know what I mean? When he died, they were there. I was not. You know what I mean? They actually had to go find me because I was out running around with my friends. This is before I started drinking. You know what I mean? This is the sort of selfishness that lives inside me that is the breeding ground of alcoholism. You know? And I think there's a lot of selfish people in the world. I'm not the only one. You know? There's a lot of selfish people that aren't alcoholics. But somewhere along the line, I found alcohol. And it helped me to be able to live that selfish way of life and go to sleep at night, you know. And that day was to finally come when I was 18. And I'm a late bloomer, you know. I know a lot of people get started early. And, you know, but I was, somehow I didn't drink much at all during high school. I had maybe a couple drinks. And the problem was that I started with beer and I thought it tasted terrible, you know. That was the deal right there. I mean, that was a, you know, I was just like, I don't know why people are drinking this. You know what I mean? It really tastes bad, you know? And especially if you're drinking at a party, you know, and it's a warm, you know, keg. I mean, it's foam. It's disgusting, you know? And so I didn't really give it too much thought. But I could see that people were getting something out of it, you know? I mean, I wanted to, you know, get something out of it, but I couldn't stomach it, you know? And I just sort of gave up on it. I mean, it didn't really mean much to me, you know. And then when I graduated high school, I moved out of my mom's house immediately. I mean, as soon as I could get going, I was gone. And I was living with some buddies, and, you know, none of us had any, you know, there was no college in the future for me or anything like that. I was working at this job, this printer, you know, screen printing T-shirts. That's what I did for a living. And it, you know, it paid pretty good. I had some money in my pocket. I had a little car I got. And, you know, I was, you know, when you're 18 and you're living at just outside the city, Washington, D.C., you know, a lot of these guys were going down to these clubs down in D.C., and I love going to these clubs, man. You know, I started going to these big warehouse parties, you know, with like thousands and thousands of people. And to me, it was a very exciting time. I mean, I had never seen anything like that, you know. It was, I fell in love with it. And nobody really knew who you were, you know. You could just kind of slip in and slip out, and no one really paid much attention to you, you know. And that's where really I started drinking. And a buddy of mine was, DJing at these parties, and he had to DJ a party up in Montreal, and he wanted me to go with him. So I went with him, and we went up to this, took a road trip up there, and we got to this club where he was performing, and we were there a little early, and, you know, I did what I usually do is I just start, you know, milling around, playing some pool. If they had a pool table, I really like playing pool, and because I'm a competitive guy, I like to start throwing money down on the table because I think I'm good, you know, most of the time I think I'm good. And but I'm a real competitive guy, and it's really, you know, the nature of my, you know, the way I was before I really got good and drunk was I was really high strung, you know. I mean, I just felt, you know, intense, you know. I would pick fights with people, you know. If I was playing pool and I missed a shot, I would break the pool stick on the pool table. You know, I might yell at someone walking by that has nothing to do with the game, you know. And so I was an intense guy. And, you know, I'm playing pool. My buddy comes over. He said, "What do you want to drink?" And I said, "I don't want beer," you know. That's what I told him. And he said, "All right, how about vodka cranberry?" And I said, "Well, yeah, sounds good, you know. I like cranberry juice." You know, being an inexperienced drinker, I have no idea, you know. "I'll drink whatever you're drinking as long as it's not beer." And so this waitress, cute waitress, starts bringing over drinks, you know. He's paying for them, at least for at the first, you know, on the first go-around, he's paying for them. So she starts bringing them over, and I start drinking, you know. And to me, it tastes good. It tastes like fruit punch, and I'm just sipping away. And, you know, I think about after the second or third drink, I felt that magic, you know, just like we all do. And I felt that warm sensation in my stomach right here in my chest cavity. You know, my hands felt funny, you know what I mean? The room sort of softened a little bit. And, you know, my shoulders relaxed, you know. I wasn't really concerned about winning the game that I was playing. And, you know, the women started to look better, you know what I mean? And, I mean, I just felt good, you know. I felt relaxed. I felt like, you know, my shots, I didn't have to second guess the shots I was taking when I was playing pool. And for a real intense guy, that's like, that's amazing. That's an amazing experience, you know. Not really caring whether or not I won or lost was huge for a guy like me, you know. Because I wrapped a lot of stuff up in that, all that ego and that pride, you know, just beating me over the head, you know. If you lose, you're a loser. There's no such thing as second place, you know. If you're a winner, you win, you know. All that stuff you hear growing up as a man, you know what I mean, all that those things, you know. I don't know where I heard them, and they're certainly not true, but those are the things I would tell myself. And so nothing bad happened that night, you know what I mean? I probably had 10 drinks, you know. I got good and drunk. I felt great. I had the time of my life, you know. And we left Montreal. We came back to D.C. And I just remember starting slowly, you know. I remember just, you know, maybe being a weekend warrior at first, you know. I had this buddy that lived in Bethesda, and he was a, you know, marijuana smoker, you know what I mean? He smoked marijuana, and I liked Captain Morgan's rum, so I would bring the rum, and he would go into his closet where he had these grow lamps, and he was growing weed, and, you know what I mean, he would cut off a couple buds, and, you know, I started learning how to smoke weed, you know, and that was great, and drinking, and his fiance at the time would cook us Spanish rice, you know what I mean, and we would just smoke weed, drink, and eat Spanish rice, and do nothing, I mean, just sit there on the couch, you know what I mean, and watch movies, and, you know, it was great. I mean, I loved it, you know. And we would do that Friday night and Saturday night. I mean, why mess up a good thing, you know what I mean? And I tell you what, if that's all I ever did in my drinking, I probably wouldn't be standing here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? If nothing bad ever happened to me smoking marijuana, I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen? You order a couple pizzas, you know, you watch Discovery Channel. I mean, you know, I got no problem with that. And but I'm an alcoholic, so I like drinking. And when I drink, you know, I like to go places. And pretty soon, the Friday night apartment was getting a little stale. You know what I mean? I had to get out there and get moving, you know. And you know, for the next 10 years, I mean, I drank. You know, I slowly traded in my life for drinking. You know what I mean? It was a choice I made, you know. And drinking didn't take anything away from me. You know, I gladly gave it up. You know, no problem, you know. And it happened subtly for me. And it was over a period of time. I mean, if I fast forward, you know, 5 years, you know, I'm drinking just about every night. I'm going to these parties. I'm going, you know, 5-6 nights a week. And, you know, and these aren't the kind of parties you go for a few hours. These are the kind of parties you show up at 10:30 at night and you're not leaving until 6 a.m., I mean, that's the kind of drinking I like to get into, you know. And you know, one of these things I noticed along the way that was sort of a red flag to my drinking, and it's probably, you know, it's probably obvious to non-alcoholics, but, you know, I would be at a club or, you know, a bar, and they've got this thing that happens at like 2 a.m., depending on where you live. Maybe it's 2:30, maybe it's 3, but it's called last call. You've probably heard of it. And it's a point in the night where you actually stop drinking, you know. Most people, you know. And they say, oh, it's the last call. And, you know, all my friends would go up. They'd get a bunch of drinks, you know what I mean, just, you know, for the next hour or so. And I would certainly drink like it was last call. You know, I would go get 2 or 3, you know, in my hand, holding them like this, you know. And but I always had somewhere else to go, you know, because I didn't want to stop drinking. You know, 2, 3 a.m. was not, you know, I was ready to keep going. And, you know, slowly but surely, you know, I'm living my life between 10 and 6 a.m., 10 at night, 6 a.m., and I'm sleeping or passing out most of the day, and I'm starting all over again at 5 o'clock. And I really thought I was living the dream, and I would be coming up Connecticut Avenue from D.C., and everyone would be going down Connecticut Avenue. I thought I had it figured out. I didn't hit any traffic or anything, you know. I said, I'm going home for the night, you know what I mean? And I would go in, you know, might stop in a 7-Eleven and, you know, all, you know, plastered. And I'd see some business guy in a suit like I'm dressed today, reading a newspaper, drinking some coffee. And I would look at him and be like, you have no idea, man. You're just a loser. You know, punching a time clock, you know what I mean, working for the man. I'm out here, you know, self-employed, you know, drug dealer, hustler, you know what I mean? You know, just, you know, making my way in the world. And I'd like to say, I didn't feel that way, but that's exactly how I felt, you know? I mean, that's the kind of arrogance I have, you know? I have this delusional arrogance. And I, you know, I tried to live that way. I tried to live as fast and furious as I could for as long as I could do it. You know what I mean? And I'd like to say that I quit drinking, but I didn't, you know? I mean, the first time I was removed from alcohol was because I was arrested, you know? I mean, that's how I was rolling. I mean, I'm not going to voluntarily come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I was having too much fun, honestly, you know? And I got a little legal trouble, my first little bit of legal trouble, you know. And I remember, you know, it was not that big of a deal. And, you know, they sent me some AA meetings, you know, and they said, you got to go to a couple AA meetings. And I was like, AA, man, hey, God, you know, give me some time. I'd rather do time than go to AA, you know what I mean? It just seemed like the end of the world to me, you know. And so I went to an AA meeting. I was drunk, you know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, maybe we all are. At least I was, my first AA meeting. And I went in late, you know, and some guys tried to talk to me after the meeting. It was a good meeting, you know what I mean? They really tried to head me off at the door. And, you know, this one guy, nice guy, gave me his phone number, wrote it down on a piece of paper, wrote his name down. And he put the A in his zeros, he put the AA symbol which is the circle and triangle, right? Which is kind of cool, I mean. But I didn't know that was the AA symbol. I thought it was kind of weird, and I was like, I'm not calling this guy. You know what I mean? So I didn't, you know what I mean? I wasn't going to call him anyway, but that sort of sealed the deal on that puppy. And I didn't stay sober, you know. I mean, obviously, of course not. And, you know, as soon as they, I was on house arrest that time, and as soon as they cut that ankle bracelet off my ankle, I mean, I was right back at the bar that night, you know. And you know how your friends are, you know, your friends. They're always happy to welcome you home and welcome back, man. It's good to see you. Here's a drink, you know. And I started, you know, I started thinking about the way I was living at that time a little bit, and you know, I really thought that I had a drug problem, if I'm honest with myself at that time. And I don't know if that's because I didn't really have any consequences around my drinking. I've never even gotten a drinking citation, you know, not a DUI, nothing, you know what I mean? Or if it's whether or not I really didn't, I think it's because I didn't want to give up my right to drink, you know? I could see myself, I could envision my life without drugs, per se, even though it was very difficult. But I could not even fathom my life without drinking, you know? Hanging out with my friends, going to the bar, I mean, my whole life was surrounded by this, you know? Football on Sundays, you know, I mean, what are you going to do if you're not drinking? I mean, it was everything to me. And so I started, you know, that sort of experimentation, you know what I mean? Like trying to control and enjoy my drinking, which is hell, you know what I mean? It's absolute hell if you're an alcoholic, because if I'm controlling my drinking, I'm miserable. If I'm not controlling if I'm enjoying my drinking, it's out of control. You know what I mean? And I did not know that I had the mental obsession and the physical allergy. I didn't know. I didn't have the language the book has. I mean, I just didn't have that language. You know, I had no language to describe it. And so I would play the game and dodging, you know, probation officers and all this stuff. And I really didn't change much. You know what I mean? And a couple of years down the road, fast forward, you know, I really became a recluse. You know, I was, you know, selling drugs. I was doing this other stuff. I mean, I was unemployable. I hadn't worked in a couple of years. And I stayed in my, you know, I was renting this house, and I stayed in the basement. I never left. I had black tarps over the windows. And I was getting very paranoid, you know what I mean, thinking people were tapping the phones and following me, and you know, and a couple months later, the DEA and ATF raided my house. So I was right. I was right. I wasn't paranoid. I was right. So doesn't bring any consolation to me, but I was right. And you know, and it was a bad deal. You know, it was a bad deal. A really bad deal. I was federally indicted, and you know, it was sort of like the end. You know what I mean? I was like, well, you know, if I make it out of this, things are never going to be the same. It was that kind of thing. I mean, it's just never going to be the same. And you know, and they tried to squeeze me for information, and you know, snitch on this guy, snitch on that. I threatened to take it to trial over a couple inconsistencies, you know, with their case, and they finally offered me a plea bargain because they didn't want to risk taking it to trial. And so, you know, I did 6-7 months. I got out, you know. Same thing. You know what I mean? Same thing. Okay, I'm not going to do any drugs, but, you know, the guy that picked me up, we went to the bar and celebrated, you know. And I was in a lot of trouble, you know. I couldn't get a job. They confiscated my passport. I mean, there was, you know, the heat was on, and so all I could really do was drink, and I drank a lot, you know, and so nothing changed for me, and I was just violating probation, and, you know, I just would, you know, I got to this place where, you know, the party was long over, you know, I wasn't going out with my friends, I wasn't, you know, I rented this one-bedroom apartment, basement apartment, I paid, you know, 4 or 5 months in advance, and I, literally just checked in there to drink myself to death, you know. I mean, that, I wouldn't have told you that's what I was doing, but that's what I was doing, you know. And I stocked up on liquor, and I got to know alcoholism, you know, like that alcoholic loneliness, you know. I mean, that very few do. And gone were all those fun times, and I was just literally drinking, passing out, and eventually I violated probation, and you know, I had a court date for sentencing, and I went to that, and this is really, you know, for me, and just like I said, I never quit drinking, you know. I was separated from alcohol, and I needed it, you know, because I wasn't going to stop drinking. And I wasn't going to come to AA. And, you know, if the love of my family and my relatives and my sisters could have gotten me sober, I would have been sober a long time ago. But I needed something bigger than that. And I think that, you know, the grace of God works through people, you know. And my judge on this violation happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Long time sober, you know. I didn't know this when he was asking me questions about AA, and I thought I was slick by answering them, you know what I mean? But he knew I was foolish, you know, full of shit. And bad deal there. I mean, I didn't see that one coming. And, you know, I sort of, you know, went to my sentencing. I took a handful of Xanax before I went just to calm the nerves, you know. You never know. Probably overdid it a little bit. And when I stood up to hear, you know, what the judgment was going to be or the sentencing, I blacked out, you know. And I came to in a holding cell inside Circuit Court in Rockville. And I tell you what, you know, most people, normal people, would probably be a bit unnerved waking up or coming to in a holding cell in Circuit Court, not knowing how much time they just got served. But I didn't feel that way. I felt a sense of ease and comfort, you know. I felt like finally the madness is over, you know, because I knew I couldn't stop drinking, you know. And in those last days, I felt those four horsemen, you know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair just, you know, beating down my butt right there. And I couldn't stop. And so I felt actually a sense of relief, you know. And, you know, I said a prayer just like we all say. Probably the first honest prayer I've ever said is, God, please help me, you know. And I think that was enough. And while I was incarcerated, people brought meetings in, and I didn't know if I was alcoholic, you know. I mean, how can you know if you're alcoholic if you haven't read the text, you know? If I haven't really gotten into the book, how can I know? There's no way. There's no way I can possibly know what it means to be an alcoholic until I really get into that book. And these good men that brought this meeting in every Wednesday night, you know, to this facility, and let me tell you, it was no joy for them, you know. I mean, there were some tough guys in there, and they would raise hell, and, I mean, it was not a, you know, if it was my commitment, I mean, it would be tough commitment, you know what I mean? But they were there every week. And something stood out to me about that, you know what I mean? There was, you know, no matter what, those guys were there, you know. And that spoke to me in some kind of way. I mean, I there's probably no way I could have understood it in its entirety. But for them to be committed to something, you know, to be there every week and come in there, it looked like they were just signing up to get grief, you know what I mean? And, you know, because I'm not like that, you know what I mean? Unless there's some sort of payoff for me, I'm not going to do it. You know, that's the kind of guy I am, you know. And I don't want a payoff that's going to pay off down the road. I need an immediate payoff. I'm an immediate payoff kind of guy, you know? So I couldn't understand that. And so it interests me, you know? And I started talking to some of these guys, you know? And they gave me a big book, and they asked me to read the doctor's opinion, you know? And I said, okay, I got plenty of time on my hands, so I could probably get through this in a week, you know what I mean? And I read the doctor's opinion, and it literally changed my life right there, you know. Because my whole life, people have been asking me, you know, what the hell is wrong with you, man? You know, why'd you do that? You know? And I would probably say some, you know, smart Alex stuff to them or make something up. But the truth was, I had no idea why I did the things I did. I had no idea why I drank when it was plainly obvious to everyone around me that that's the worst thing you could do. But that's what I did. I couldn't answer those questions, you know. But the doctor's opinion answered those questions for me. And I started to realize that the reason I didn't see anything in Alcoholics Anonymous the first time I went is because I didn't understand what alcoholism was, you know. What I saw were a bunch of people that were in a room not drinking and they were real happy, you know. And I was in a room not drinking, but I was not happy about it, you know. And I could not understand that, you know. So I thought that whatever you had, I didn't have that. You know, maybe there's something else wrong with me. And it's only until you read the doctor's opinion that you realize that drinking really isn't the problem for me. For an alcoholic of my type, it's living sober. It's not drinking, you know. I am in this constant state of restlessness, irritability, discontent. Unless I can again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And that is really what's wrong with me. And I related that because I explained to you how I felt before I drank. I was real tightly wound. I mean, that's the language I had to describe it. I couldn't have described it in the way that the doctor described it. And so I started to understand that drinking's not really the problem here. It's staying sober, you know. How do I walk through life, you know, that I don't understand without drinking, without that solution? And I was really at a loss. I didn't know how to do it. And so I started hanging out with these guys, and we would go through the book, and they told me to go to some meetings when I got out. They told me to go to Midtown. They actually told, despite the rumors and all of the nonsense that was going on, these guys that were in service knew the deal. And they were like, this is where you should go. And that's where I went, you know. And as soon as I could get out of there, I was in a pre-release center, and I was sort of pre-release center, sort of you're halfway locked up. You're not all the way locked up, but you still got a number, and you got to get frisked every time you come in. And that's where I met my sponsor. He was coming in there to visit someone else he knew there. And I, you know, to me, you know, my sobriety is, you know, the result of a lot of well-meaning people in Alcoholics Anonymous taking their time to reach out to me. You know, I cannot take credit for my sobriety, you know. And if it weren't for these people like the judge and, you know, my sponsor coming in and taking his time to talk to some loser, you know, I mean, he didn't know me, you know. And we went out on the patio there and, you know, we were smoking and he told me a story, you know. And what got me about his story was that he seemed to drink like I did. But the person standing in front of me didn't look like that. You know what I mean? I could not understand how that transformation happened, you know. But I was interested in it because I knew that that was going to have to happen for me, you know. And so I asked him right there on the spot. I said, will you be my sponsor? And he, you know, he had some questions he wanted to ask me first. Will you call me every day, you know, follow direction? And I said, yes. Not knowing what that really entailed, you know. If I had really known, I probably would have tried to bargain with him a little bit. But I said yes, you know. And I think at that very moment, I was as willing as I was ever going to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the truth, you know. And that's what I said. The longer I stay sober, the more I have to do. Because that kind of desperation, that kind of hopelessness, you know what I mean, I cannot manufacture that now. You know, the only way I can see it is through the guys I sponsor. You know, I can, you know, my life is totally different now. You know, so that's the only way I can see it is through the guys I sponsor. And for that moment, I asked him to sponsor me, and he started taking me around all these meetings he goes to, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know AA like that existed. You know, and I just loved it, and I made a commitment to really do whatever he asked me to do. I really made that commitment. And I didn't put any sort of, you know, a lot of guys come into AA and it's, you know, they put conditions on their sobriety. I mean, right out of the gate, you know. Well, I'll do this only if I get this. Well, I'll do this much only if I don't have to do that, you know. And I really try not to put any conditions on my sobriety. And I really didn't have much anyway. I mean, I had nothing going for me. I was 29 years old. You know, everything I had fit in two trash bags, I certainly wasn't winning at the game of life, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to claim, you know, it's hard to claim I know what I'm doing if I'm, my life is being managed by the state of Maryland. You know what I mean? That's a hard claim to make, you know. My life is being managed by this outside facility. I mean, what the hell do I know? You know what I mean? And I started going to meetings, and one day at a time. I mean, I think I was 2 months sober. I was out of that place. I moved in with some sober guys, and I think I was 2 months sober. And I realized that I was 2 months out on the street, sober, without a drink. You know, and that had not happened for me since I had started drinking. You know, I mean, it's easy for a guy like me to stay sober when I'm locked up, right, or I'm in the hospital, or you know what I mean? I mean, that's easy, but when you let me out, that's a different deal, you know? And it was very clear to me at that moment that the only reason that I was sober is because I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I was following this guy's direction. I was doing what he told me to do, you know? Because on my own, there's no way, you know? That was like a second step for me, you know? I could see that this power greater than myself was restoring me to sanity, you know? That mental obsession was starting to get pushed back, you know. And I wasn't thinking about drinking in the same way that I used to, you know. To me, it started to seem like poison. And I was terrified for my first couple of years of drinking. I was terrified. I didn't want to be alone, you know. I didn't want to, you know, I was quick to move in with some sober guys. But I couldn't trust myself, you know. If I'm alone, I mean, I'm a shortcut kind of guy, you know, corner cutter, you know what I mean. I like to get the maximum results out of the most minimal effort possible. You know what I mean? And if I'm alone, I will always cut corners. So I needed some guys around me that were going to hold me accountable. And I started to really understand what alcoholism was. I really started to understand the malady. I mean, I don't think I really had a firm grasp on a first step until I was 5 years sober, you know? It took a lot of work to really see the inner workings of my alcoholism and really the true nature of it and how it lives inside me, you know. And I got started on a four-step, and, you know, I really gave my sponsor veto power over my life, you know. If he didn't want me to do something, I said okay, you know. And that's a hard thing to do. I mean, you really, like it says in that third step, you really got to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And he was a smart guy, you know, and I would argue with him about some things, and he would say, well, why don't you give me some experiences or evidence that you have that says that you know how to do what it is that you're saying you know how to do? And I couldn't give him anything, because the only thing I've ever done in the last 10 years was drink and get locked up, you know what I mean? So I had no information on any sort of success plans, you know, in my life, And so, I mean, he would just sort of chip away at my ego like that, little by little. And I started a four-step. I didn't understand what I was doing. How could you? I mean, how can you understand the relevance of a four-step? You know, I mean, it's impossible, you know. If you've never done one, I mean, here I am. You know, inventory in any shape or form is a foreign concept to a derelict like me. I mean, when we were out running and gunning with my friends, we never stopped to say for a minute, like, hold on, now, where were we at fault with this? What's our part, you know? What are the mistakes we made in this relationship, you know what I mean? I mean, there was none of that, you know? We just did whatever we wanted to do, and we just kept drinking, you know? And drinking solved all those problems. You don't need to ask those questions if you're drinking, you know? But the problem is I'm not drinking anymore, and I'm riddled with shame and guilt and these things that I've done out there. And I cannot drink to hide them anymore. I cannot drink to hide the nightmares that I have when I go to bed, the faces that I see every night, you know. I mean, I'm the kind of drunk, you know, where if you're ODing on the floor, I will step over you and head right out the door. You know what I mean? Not because I got somewhere else to go, because I don't want to be involved when the cops or the police show up. You know what I mean? Just looking out for number one. And I would see those things at night when I went to bed, and you know, you got to get that stuff out. And I had to get that stuff out. And I was as honest as I could be at the time. And I feel like, you know, I put everything out on paper. Because what do I got to lose, man? I've got nothing anyway. you know. So what do I got to lose? And I tell you what, I mean, there's some promises after the fifth step, but I did not feel like I was walking hand in hand in the sunlight of the Spirit. I felt disgusted about what I saw there on those on that paper. And I did not like the person that was described in that fourth step. And you know, and I felt good that I knew my sponsor better. I felt like we had a relationship now, you know. I felt like I was a member in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I actually done some tangible work to stay here. And so I felt good about some of those things. But I didn't feel good about some of the stuff I had written down on that piece of paper. And I did what a lot of people do after they do a fourth and fifth step. I sort of coasted around in AA, kind of hanging out in the fellowship, feeling good and working and getting mine. And, you know, and some things improved in my life, you know. I got a better job, you know. I started, you know, moving around a little bit, getting a better place to live. And, you know, but at some point, you know, I got in a relationship, of course. You know, that's always a good thing to do. And I started feeling like, I started getting that feeling back like AA wasn't big enough for a hotshot like me, you know. All you guys going to your little meetings and, you know, sharing and, you know, these wretched AA dances, you know. I mean, I was, you know, I was a big-time drug dealer, club-goer guy, you know what I mean? I'm not going to go to an AA dance, you know what I mean? Just stupid, you know. Started thinking like that, and, you know, and then I caught myself one day. I was like, I'm headed for trouble, you know what I mean? If that's the way you feel about alcohol, if you feel that way tonight about AA, you're in trouble, you know what I mean? And my sponsor, my grand sponsor, pulled me up, and this is a good thing about being in a home group with a legacy of sponsorship. I mean, you can't hide out for very long. Someone's going to get you, your grand sponsor, your great-grand sponsor, your great-great-grand sponsor. And he pulled me up one night. He said, you know, have you started your eighth step? I said, no. He said, sounds like instincts on a rampage, Balkan investigation, you know. And I didn't know what that meant, of course, because I hadn't done an eighth step. You know what I mean? I couldn't grasp what he was saying. But it sounded serious, so I started on my A-step. You know what I mean? It sounded pretty serious, so I got busy on that puppy. And, you know, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, my A-step was, you know, it was a disaster. You know, I mean, everything I had written down, I mean, it was a nightmare. You know, I owed everybody. If you had loved and trusted me at some point, you know, I hurt you. You know what I mean? Almost everyone I had been in contact with that had that kind of relationship with me, I took advantage of it and I hurt you, you know. If you had lent me money, I stole it, which means I hadn't paid it back, by the way. If you owe money, I mean, it's like stealing, you know. And it's their money. I have it. You know what I mean? And it was a mess. And slowly but surely, I started working through these amends with my sponsor. And I didn't go it alone. I didn't make any decisions. He told me exactly what to do for each one, and that's what I did. And this stuff wasn't easy, you know. If you think what's involved in paying money back, right, even the smallest amount of money, there's a lot that needs to happen in my life for me to be able to do that. One, I need to be able to wake up on time to go to a job. I need to have a job, you know. I need to show up to that job. I need to not yell at my boss so I can keep that job. You know what I mean? I need to be a good employee so I can keep getting pay raises so I can pay this money off. I mean, there was so much involved in this, you know. What's involved in making amends to my mom, you know? I got to show up in her life, you know, over and over and over again, you know, be consistent with that relationship, you know, show up for her. You know, what she asked me to do, I do it. You know what I mean? And I would say, you know, there's a lot that happens in the eighth step before I ever make a face-to-face amend, you know. You know, amends means change. If I am still living the same way in these relationships, there's no amends, you know. For, you know, I'm sorry is not going to cut it. It's not going to cut it anymore. And I had to do a lot of changing in these relationships. And it was many years had gone by before I was in a position to make a face-to-face amends with some of these people. Many years. You know, and, you know, I finally paid everyone back. And, you know, I mean, you know, these amends in my mind never stop, you know. because I still have a relationship with my mother. She still wants to know I'm her son, you know. She still wants to know that when she calls, I'm going to be there, you know. She called me on Friday and wanted me to move a chair yesterday, you know, come take it to the upholsterers. I said, okay, you know. I didn't really want to do it, you know what I mean. There were other things I wanted to do, but I did it, you know, because that's what she wants. And some of this stuff has come to pass, you know, these amends, I've made them. I mean, some of them were amazing. Some of them were, you know, disturbing, you know, sad. I mean, you really get to see the true depths of your selfishness when you make these face-to-face amends, because you can see the pain in their eyes, you know. I mean, some of this stuff, you know, if you sit with my family at a dinner for more than an hour, what I had done in the past will come up. They'll bring it up. I'm telling you. You know what I mean? My sisters now think it's kind of, you know, but my mom doesn't think it's funny. You know? I mean, she really is still deeply hurt by what her son had become for the, you know, 12, 13 years. You know? I robbed her of the privilege of bragging about me to her friends. You know? Oh, how's Chris doing? Well, he's locked up. Again, you know what I mean, and I, you know, and so this stuff is still going on today. You know, I still got to be there, and I still got to show up, and I still got to be, you know, financially manageable with my money. You know, I mean, I think there's a spiritual axiom there with your money. You know, if you are reckless with your money, I mean, there's probably something else you're reckless with. You know what I mean, and. It took a long time for me to understand how to live this way of life, you know, in every area of my life. And, you know, and I still take an inventory all the time with my sponsor, you know. I mean, I think humility is knowing exactly who and what I am and the honest desire to be something different. And how can I be something different if I'm not taking an inventory regularly, you know. I mean, the thing with me, I mean, is pride and ego, you know. That's what I struggle with 12 years sober. I mean, the ego just does whatever it wants, and pride is right there to justify it. No, you're good, man. You don't need to go to a meeting tonight. Yeah, I got 12 years sober. You're right. I don't need to go to a meeting. Someone else will do that service position. Someone else will help that guy. And after I had done these nice step amends, something amazing happened. You know, I was able to really listen to newcomers, you know, when they were talking to me. I was really... You know, I wasn't thinking about all this garbage that I had back in my head, you know, all this unfinished business that used to saddle me, you know, every waking moment. You know, I could really hear what they were saying. I could, you know, listen to them in a way that I hadn't been able to listen to them before, you know. And I think that's really the goal, you know, with these nine step amends, to be a maximum service to God and his fellows. Now, that's not why I did them, you know. I did them because I wanted to get out of debt and I didn't want my mom to be pissed at me anymore, but... You know, but the benefit of it was is that I was placed in a position where I could be useful to someone else, you know. And I think my 11th step is very simple, you know. I think we grow along spiritual lines through hard work and self-sacrifice for others. And that's it. I mean, I don't make it too complicated. If I get too in the weeds with it, you know, I won't stick to it. And I get on my knees every morning because I think it's important, not because I'm religious, but I think it's important that I humble myself to the process here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I don't, I'm going to be out of here. You know, if I cannot at least humble myself to the process here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm a goner. You know, because my ego will be right back there in charge again, and who knows what I'll be doing. And most of the time today, I try to live my life. I try to live my life in the way that the 12-step sort of describes. I try to live by principle in all my affairs. I try to, you know, seek God wherever I can in these relationships with these new guys. I try to take people through the steps, and when I'm taking them through the steps, I'm going through the steps, and I try to stay in contact with my sponsor. I talk to him every other day, and I, you know, because I'm not well, you know what I mean? I'm still not well. I mean, I, you know, and I was talking to Billy before the meeting about it. I mean, it's, you know, some of these people are leaving. You know, they got about 12 years, you know. And they're leaving because things are good. They're not leaving because things are bad, you know. I mean, that's the the great double-edged sword of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It repairs you. It gives you everything you need, you know, love and success and happiness. But it's your job to stay here and stay committed like you're still dying from alcoholism. Hard to do, you know. Impossible to do on my own, you know. That's why I have to keep reaching my hand out, you know. I try to stay on the firing line. I try to go to meetings where there are newcomers, you know. Even if I don't like the meeting, you know. And believe me, there are a lot I don't like, but I go there because the newcomers are there, you know. And because to me, that's the lifeline. That's the connection, you know. Because my story will not keep me sober, you know. All those consequences seem to be a lifetime ago, you know. It's not going to keep me sober. And I think there's a difference between sober and really sober and happy, you know. I want the most that AA has to offer. I don't want to just be dry, you know. I really want to feel the highs and lows and the joys of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I don't think I can tap into that unless I'm really giving 100% of myself. And, you know, and I hope that I always remain in a position to do that. And, you know, before I shut up and sit down, I think that before, while I was drinking, if you told me that AA would give me the same sort of feelings that alcohol gave me, I think I would have been sold right there on that. You know what I mean? Well, that's pretty good. If AA will make me feel like I felt like when I was drinking, I'm in, you know. But the truth is after having gone through the steps, you know, taking an inventory, making amends, reaching my hand out to newcomers, watching their lives transform in front of my eyes, you know, seeing these relationships transform in front of me, I know for sure there's no way that drinking, the feeling that came from drinking, could ever replace the feelings I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, that is a big deal, you know. That's a big deal. And so I know if you're new tonight in Alcoholics Anonymous, you have no shot on your own. Get a sponsor, you know, get a home group, and do what they ask you to do. And I hope you keep coming back. Thanks.